I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We're back for the new year. Mike Polignano is still traveling, so he'll join us next week. And today I want to begin by running through a bunch of donations, since it's been a while since we've done that. And I want to thank as many people as possible by name or pseudonym or whatever. So we had a couple of completely anonymous donations from the realm of the cryptocurrencies. So thank you. You know who you are. We got $275 from John, $50 from Bjorn's son, $100 from Leveler, $100 from The Sound of Music, $30 from Mike, $20 from Chad, $1,000 from another Chad, $2,000 from Daniel, $40 from Eric, $80 from Bill, $50 from Jay, $100 from a Turkish ally, that's an interesting story, $260 from Armstrong, $100 from Hunt, $10 from Webster, $150 from Keegan, $3 from Jose, $20 from John, $25 from Elliot, $100 from Edward, $50 from Jeff, $40 from Quinn, $40 from Christian, $100 from Dominic, another $30 from Dominic, the same Dominic, thank you very much for both of those, $50 from Jeff, $50 from Mike, $200 from Emil, $50 from Miles, $50 from Rolf, and $100 from Christian. I don't even have the total, but that's quite a lot, and it brought us over our $60,000 goal for the year, and we thank you very, very much.
Yes, thanks to everybody, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you all. So Countercurrents is off to a flying start in 2018, and one of the things I want to do today is talk to John Morgan about an important figure in his intellectual life, and the topic of an article in North American New Right, Volume 2. And the topic is Colin Wilson. So, John, can you give us a brief overview of Colin Wilson's life and how you came to know his work?
Sure. I'll just mention, though, that back when Colin died, which was in December of 2013, I wrote an extensive obituary slash introduction to his works that appeared at Countercurrents at the time. All of that is still in the version that's going to be in North American New Right, but I did revise it considerably, and I added a lot of extra material. So it's essentially a new essay now, although it contains everything from the original. But people who want to know more might want to go look at that. I first encountered Colin Wilson in 1995. At the time, I was in the middle of my tenure at the University of Michigan as an undergraduate, but I'd actually dropped out for a period of about a year and a half because I was really frustrated with what I was doing, and I had intended to go there to study literature, and then later I got interested in philosophy as well. But after a while, I started to see, you know, the changes that had taken place in the modern academy and how far removed it had gotten from those essential questions that I wrote about in my Why I Write piece for Countercurrents recently about, you know, why are we here? What is the point of our lives? You know, what is the point of our civilization? Why is it worth preserving? These were all things I was already thinking about back then, but I wasn't finding very satisfactory answers to those questions at the university. So I was just working a regular job to make ends meet, but I was reading a lot, and I happened to walk by the Borders in downtown Ann Arbor when that still existed, and they happened to have out on their remainder table a copy of Colin's book Beyond the Outsider, which is actually, I believe, the fourth volume in what later came to be called his Outsider's Cycle, which you could say is really the core of his philosophical thinking, those six books, actually. And I read it, and I found it very interesting. What attracted me to it was that Colin was dealing with issues related to existentialism. Like a lot of people when they're around undergraduate age, I'd gotten very interested in the existentialists. You know, I was reading Camus' The Stranger and Sartre and Nietzsche, of course, and these things. But what it struck me about them was that while they kind of presented this idea that we were free to make our own lives, and that, you know, being precedes essence, and that you know, you can kind of, you know, it, essentially existentialism says that we're free to become whatever we want to become, that nothing is predetermined for us by, you know, some kind of metaphysical constraints. And I found that very appealing as a young man. But I always found the way that the French existentialists in particular dealt with it to be unsatisfactory. It seemed like while they acknowledge the fact that we're free to, you know, basically to become great heroic things, their books always seem to end up kind of putting us back down into the muck, you know, and kind of saying that, well, you know, man is condemned to be free, and we're in this awful world where everything is just darkness and despair. And, you know, sure, there's no God, so, you know, we're free to do whatever we want. But, you know, in the end, you know, every choice is the same anyway, because we're all condemned to this sort of absurd, meaningless life. And while there, you know, when you're young, when you're in your late teens or early 20s, you can find that kind of despair. Yeah, there's something that kind of resonates with you in kind of a, you know, kind of the same way that, like, I don't know, goth music does or something like that. When you're around that age, things that are dark appeal to you. I guess perhaps because, you know, when you are that age and you're first going out into the world, it's quite terrifying. And I guess it's somewhat reassuring to, you know, have these things that affirm that, well, you know, if life seems unfair to you, that's because it is, you know, the world is this unfair place. But before long, I began to found that to not be satisfactory. And, you know, I really wanted something more. And Colin, as I realized in reading this book, was calling for another form of existentialism. He said that the existentialists were on to something good, but that they allowed themselves to fall back into the same pessimism that the Romantics had in the 19th century. You know, the Romantics also had this kind of Faustian sense of, you know, that man is capable of achieving anything if he just puts his will and his intellect into it and his strength. You know, a man can become anything. But in the end, you know, a lot of the Romantics, like Colin himself was fond of pointing out, always ended up either committing suicide or becoming drug addicts or alcoholics, or, you know, again, writing about how, you know, everything in the end is crap or whatever. So Colin really called for a kind of positive existentialism and a positive understanding of freedom. And he actually, for him, pessimism was not just when you say that you think that, you know, everything is hopeless or whatever. He actually thought that when you have a pessimistic attitude, drawing on phenomenological understanding of how we experience reality, he thought you were actually limiting your ability to perceive the world as it is, because the phenomenologists thought that, you know, perception is an act of will, that in order to perceive something, the mind has to, you know, go out and grab it. But of course, if you refuse to believe that something exists, even when that thing is, you know, a positive way of looking at your own life or looking at the possibilities of life, then, you know, you will fail to see it. And Colin believed that people who are pessimists were actually condemning themselves as well as their followers to living in this sort of limited world where, you know, we're just condemned to this drudgery and darkness and despair, when in fact, you know, there are boundless possibilities open to us that people like that just refuse to see. And this was, for me at that age, it was really something amazing. So I was very fortunate in that the University of Michigan Library, where I was at the time, has a very good library. So I went and tried to find more of Colin's books and also more about who he was. And I was really fascinated to find out that he wasn't just a writer on philosophy, but he had written many, many books on existentialism, on crime, on criminology, on psychology. In his later years, he got into the occult and mysticism. We can talk about that a bit later, perhaps. He wrote many novels. He wrote a few books that it's hard to even classify. Like, he wrote a book on wine, which was one of the great loves of his life. Books on music, classical music, was something he liked a lot. Science fiction, that was something he was very interested in. And it seemed like everything that I was interested in at the time, Colin was interested in as well. And even more to the point, he tried to synthesize it all and attach it to these larger themes that I've been discussing. So it was just amazing to me. I mean, the fact that somebody would even assert that there can be a meaning to life. I mean, given the kinds of stuff I'd been having to read in my university courses, I mean, this was a breath of fresh air, mentally speaking. And his life, I would say, was quite inspiring as well. I mean, he never even finished what we would consider to be high school in America. He left school at 16, which was normal, in England at the time he lived. I mean, he was born in 1934, if I remember correctly. I think that's right. And when he finished school in the 1950s, he was from a working class background. His father was a boot and shoe worker who did that for a living. His mother was a housewife. And, you know, he came from a completely unremarkable background. He did not come from a family of artists or intellectuals, at all. And certainly not from England's, aristocracy. But he was always proud of that fact. And he left school at 16. His first interest was in science. He looked to become a chemist at first, in fact. And he, was working in a chemistry laboratory for a couple of years after he left school. But the same thing happened. You know, he found that science was very interesting to him, but he found that it failed to answer these larger questions of what is the meaning of life. And he often told the story about how one day, when he was working at this laboratory, he actually decided to commit suicide because he couldn't see any reason, to keep on living. So he recounted how he went into the lab one day and, I think it was hydrochloric acid, but I'm not completely sure, but there was something in the laboratory that he knew if he drank it, you know, he would just die instantly. So he went into the lab, to work one day and just walked past his coworkers and he, went into the reagent room where they kept all the chemicals, took it down from the shelf and he said he was ready to drink it when he suddenly had this vision. That there were actually two Colin Wilsons, and one Colin Wilson was this depressed teenager, and he said he realized it didn't matter if he died at all, but there was this other Colin Wilson that was, you know, this heroic figure who, you know, would further the boundaries of human knowledge, and he realized that was the Colin he could become, and he said it wouldn't matter if the depressed Colin Wilson died at all, but the tragedy would be that he'd be taking the other Colin Wilson with him. So he said they resolved at that moment not to go through with him. He put the chemicals back on the shelf and went about his work. And he said he soon left the job at the laboratory. He ended up doing a bunch of menial jobs in factories and some kind of low-level office work. But he was very busily reading the classics of literature and philosophy at this time. And that's how he got interested in Nietzsche and the existentialists. And he began writing the first manuscripts that became, you know, his initial books. But he said he soon realized that the amount of time he was spending on work was making it impossible for him to actually write anything. So he finally decided that he got some savings together and got rid of his apartment and was living on Hampstead Heath in London, which is a park in London. He just bought himself a sleeping bag, and I guess he had an umbrella that he would put over it to protect him in case it rained. And he would spend his nights there, you know, sleeping. And during the days, he would go to the reading room at the British Museum and work on his books. And it just so happened that the head of the reading room at that time was Angus Wilson, who anyone who studied 20th century English literature will certainly know the name because he's one of the best known English novelists of that time. And they got to talking since Colin was there every day. And when Colin mentioned that he was working on a book, he asked to see it. I should mention Angus Wilson was already well known at this time. He'd already published several books. So Colin gave him the draft of what would later become his first novel, which was called Ritual in the Dark. Angus read it and told him that it was very good and encouraged him to try to publish. But Colin did not end up publishing the novel first. His first book ended up being The Outsider. And that was a book that dealt with all the themes that I was just discussing. Although the main thesis of that book is that outsiders, which are what he called in another book, he said that the pimples on the face of a civilization that has lost its sense of inner health. He analyzed the problem of the artist, well, I should say the outsider, through the artist, those who feel alienated from the society around them. And Colin did not feel that the problem was with the outsiders themselves, but rather with the fact that modern civilization has basically failed such people, that it's no longer a suitable vehicle for people who seek to overcome themselves and to achieve higher meaning. Colin thought in previous ages that, you know, that had been accomplished in religion and in art and so forth, but he thought in the 20th century, all of that was basically unavailable to the outsider, and he was kind of forced to discover his own meaning. But unlike the French existentialists, Colin saw this as heralding, you know, a new type of freedom, you know, the type of man who could realize himself completely. And these kinds of themes, I'm sure, will sound familiar to people who've studied the traditionalists, because Evola, of course, dealt with similar themes, as did Guénon. And in fact, Evola talked about Colin Wilson briefly in one of the essays that he wrote in the late 1950s. I think it's in Youth's Beats and Right-Wing Anarchists, if I remember the title correctly. It's been translated. But, you know, Evola, he appreciated that Colin was addressing the same sorts of problems that he did, but he also criticized Colin for not, you know, coming to the understanding of tradition, because when he was young, Colin did explore religion as a possibility for resolving the outsider's dilemma. But he ultimately rejected it because he thought religion was something of the past and that it was also inherently limited. He thought that it was possible to develop something like a new sacred sense, but without the need for, you know, some kind of organized institution like the church. And that's really what launched his career, because he found a publisher for it. It was published in May of 1956, and it was immediately became a bestseller in both England and in the U.S. And he was almost like a superstar celebrity for about a year until he got his comeuppance in the mainstream media in England. But that's perhaps another story. But that's basically how I got interested in him and sort of the basics of where Colin was coming from.
Did he ever write about Heidegger? I know he wrote about existentialism. Did he ever encounter Heidegger?
He referred to Heidegger on many occasions. Yeah, but he seemed to be much more interested in Nietzsche. Nietzsche was the philosopher he seemed to come back to the most, and the other existentialists, like the French existentialists, I should say. I don't recall, he never wrote a book on Heidegger. I'll have to check in his bibliography. It's possible he wrote some essays about Heidegger specifically. I'll have to get back to you on that. But I wouldn't say that Heidegger was one of his major influences.
Yeah, existentialism always struck me as, well, a little absurd to say that we do really have unbounded possibilities, because how do you fit in things like biological determinism and so forth into that? We only inherit certain determinate potentialities. I mean, how would he respond to that? Did he regard that as a real problem or not?
Oh, absolutely. Another one of his major points that he reiterates in many of his books is he talked about some research that was done where they found out that during the Second World War, when the Japanese would put Americans and Brits into prisoners of war camp, they discovered that it was only about 5% of the population of the prisoner population that would actually cause problems for them. And these were the most assertive, dominant individuals. So the Japanese apparently figured out that if they kept this 5%, if they determined who they were and imprisoned them away from the other prisoners, that they experienced very few problems. There are some other examples he cites as well. That was just one of them. But he always believed that there was this 5% of the population that was the truly dominant class of humanity. And he thought that, you know, the outsiders were part of that class, whether they, you know, acknowledged it or not. And he thought that all of the great artists and philosophers and musicians and so forth fell into that 5%. You know, what he blamed modernity for doing is, you know, sort of like the traditionalists did as well, is, you know, trying to convince everybody that they were equal when in fact, you know, he thought it was very important for outsiders to understand that they were not equal to everybody else and that it was their responsibility, you know, to achieve these higher things. So yeah, he was very well of that. And I would say he definitely was an elitist. He never explicitly brings race into his work, but I mean, all of his references in his work from the 50s until, you know, his last works in the 2000s, he only ever refers to Western sources, you know, European and American sources with very few exceptions. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear that we could say it's implicitly white. his way of looking at things. There are a few interesting comments he makes in his lectures. Like there's one I've heard from the 1960s where he was addressing an audience and he refers to the fact that there's a lot more immigrants around London these days. And he said, oh, you know, I really don't like that because I've always detested foreigners. And he just kind of continues with the lecture and doesn't go back to that. So I think he was kind of like us, but maybe I should say that till we get into more about his politics. But I definitely think he was an elitist, and he never really fully fleshed this idea out. But he certainly realized that biology was something that played into the outsider problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, well, let's talk about his politics now. Where was he in the political spectrum? I understand that he actually was friendly with Sir Oswald Mosley and that Mosley reviewed The Outsider, and we reprinted that in recent months at Countercurrents, actually. So let's talk about his politics.
I would say that Colin overall was mostly apolitical. He engaged in very little overt political activity in his lifetime. But like I said, there's certainly an implicit viewpoint there that I think is pretty clearly conservative. You know, perhaps not radical right, but certainly conservative. When he first, before the publication of The Outsider, he did get involved with a couple of anarchist groups in London, and he was actually a speaker for a couple of them. But from everything I've read, I mean, nothing, he didn't publish anything in that period, so nothing really survives of it in his writings. But as far as I've been able to get from his biographies, he didn't really attach any particular importance to it. He later claimed that he was practicing his public speaking in doing it. And he said he would inevitably get kicked out of these anarchist groups because he said that until they dealt with the questions of human meaning and human despair, that, you know, they would never amount to anything. And this would always lead to them accusing him of being a reactionary or whatever and throwing him out. But I wouldn't read too much into that. I think it was, you know, just something he dabbled in his youth. But, at the time that The Outsider was published, he was invited to have lunch with Oswald Mosley at a hotel in London. I can't remember the name of it, but it's in my essay. And they really hit it off. And Colin always insisted whenever he mentioned Mosley that Mosley was one of the most intelligent people he'd ever met. And I know that he mentions in his writings that they met several more times after that. I don't have any details about it. You know, nothing much has been recorded about it, and Colin's biographers, for obvious reasons, have usually tried to just ignore all of this. Like in Gary Lachman's book, Beyond the Robots, which actually is a very good biography and overview of Colin, I would say, but he completely omits any reference to Mosley in the book. You know, I don't think I need to explain why, but I you know, it is certainly a disservice in one sense, I would think. Yeah, and you're right. Mosley, in his journal, The European, which he edited, or I think his wife edited, actually, at the time, a few months after The Outsider was published, he published this very long rave review of The Outsider, which he did offer Colin some advice. I wouldn't say that he thought the book was perfect, but he clearly thought very highly of Colin. And I've heard in a number of places that, you know, they corresponded until Mosley's death in 1980. They were always in contact. And I should mention that in 1957, about a year after The Outsider was published, there were some incidents that happened. Like, Colin had a fiancée named Joy, who ended up being his wife for more than 50 years afterwards. But they were still only dating at the time. And Joy's father came across some notes for a novel that Colin was, well, actually it was Ritual in the Dark that I mentioned before. And one of the characters is a serial killer who's also a sexual deviant. And Colin had been taking some notes on this character's mentality. And Joy's father came across them and thought that it was Colin's own thoughts. So he ended up going over to Colin's apartment and threatening to beat him up or something. And then the police were called. It ended up being a huge scandal in the British newspapers. And people were, you know, in the very British way, they were kind of making fun of him, because for the whole year prior to that, he'd been in every newspaper and every magazine in Britain constantly. And Colin himself wrote in later years that, you know, he understood that people were probably getting sick of hearing about him, because, you know, he was being praised as this young genius and so forth. So the press was very eager, as, you know, as they would be today as well, you know, to kind of put him in his place. And he never really recovered from that. You know, for the rest of his life, up to and including his obituaries, I'm sorry to say, the press always chose to take a very derogatory, you know, almost mocking tone of him, you know, saying that he wasn't worthy of being taken seriously as a thinker and so forth. One of the things they always used against him was his friendship with Mosley. And they always tried to use that to prove that he was always a fascist, even though there are several places in Colin's writings where he insists that, you know, he considers Mosley to be a genius and considers him to be a friend, but this is in spite of what he sees as his error in embracing fascism. So I feel I should qualify that by saying that Colin wasn't completely negative towards Mosley's politics. In fact, there's an essay he wrote in the 1970s that maybe we should rerun this, A Countercurrents, actually, because I have the text of it. But Colin actually praises aspects of Mosley's program in it, such as his, you know, he actually says that what Mosley was proposing in the late 40s was basically the European Union before there was a European Union, just, you know, along anti-liberal lines. And he actually mentions in this essay, he says, well, Mosley's stance on immigration was just as sensible as Enoch Powell's, and things like that. So I certainly would not say that Colin rejected Mosley's fascism because he was a liberal, but just because he was more, I would say, of a conservative at heart, you know, of a Tory. So there's not much more to say about it than that. That he did occasionally write about Mosley over the years. There's a handful of articles he wrote where he talks about Mosley and his opinion of him. But I wouldn't try to say that it was a major influence on Colin's career, but it's certainly an interesting side note. And, of course, there's Bill Hopkins as well.
Yeah, say a little bit about Bill Hopkins and the Angry Young Man and the Jonathan Bowden connection and all that.
Colin knew Bowden. They were about the same age, even before Colin had been published in the mid-50s.
Oh, you're talking about Hopkins, Bill Hopkins.
Yes. Yeah, I think they first became friends around 1954 or something like that, because they were both intellectuals in London at that time, and they were interested in the same sorts of things. And they were lifelong friends, just like Colin was with Mosley. In fact, I believe Hopkins outlived Colin by a couple of years. I think he just died a few years ago, right?
I think Hopkins died in 2011.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, actually, Colin was basically an invalid by that time because he had a stroke in 2009, and he wasn't really able to do much after that. But okay, so they basically lived about the same length of time. But they at the same time that The Outsider was published, there was a play by John Osborne that premiered in London called Look Back in Anger. And it reflected not so much the same ideas as Colin's work, but this sort of dissatisfaction that young Brits had with British society in the 1950s. I guess you could say they were sort of like British beatniks, you know, like the beatniks were in America. This sort of sense of alienation from British society. And people decided to lump Colin Wilson from The Outsider in with John Osborne, and also Kingsley Amis, Alan Sillitoe, several other people who I can't remember right now, but also Bill Hopkins, who was just becoming known at that time. And they decided to collectively name them the Angry Young Men. Colin was never really that happy with being lumped in with these other people, but at the time, you know, he said it was kind of ingratiating to be part of a literary and artistic movement. So Hopkins is part of that as well. And there was a book that was published around 1957 or 1958 called Declaration. And it was sort of the manifesto of the Angry Young Men. And all of them had essays in it, including Colin. And Bill Hopkins had one as well. I don't remember the name of it, but you've rerun it at Countercurrents, Greg.
Right.
Many years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. So he wrote one other book after that called The Divine and the Decay, which was later reprinted in the 1980s under the title The Leap. You can still find copies online, at least of the Leap edition. The earlier one is hard to get. But it's actually about the leader of what seems to be a fascist party. And he kind of considers himself above morality, and he's on this fictional British island, ostensibly on vacation, but he's actually just there to get an alibi for the murder of one of his political rivals back in London. So it kind of deals with a very unusual theme. But Colin praised the novel quite highly. He wrote an introduction to the second edition of the book, in which he basically calls it one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. And he always openly admitted that Hopkins considered himself to be a fascist. But he was always kind of scolding him for that, because he always said that, oh, you know, think of how many books you could have written if you just devoted yourself to literature instead of politics. Because Hopkins was running this group called the Spartacus League, which there's very little information on it that's available. They never published anything. But apparently Hopkins saw it as the basis for a new right-wing political party, a radical right-wing political party. And Colin gave a lecture on it, actually on this 5% elite idea that I mentioned. But after that, Hopkins became an art dealer. And that's actually how he made his living for the rest of his life. So he actually never published anything else, I think, other than a few poems. Like, I know Troy Southgate published a few poems by him, but he didn't write anything substantial after the 50s. But Hopkins, in later years, did become friends with Jonathan Bowden. I don't really know any details about that other than the fact that they knew each other. Do you know anything more about that, Greg?
Honestly, no, I don't. I know that Bowden, early on, was sort of making Colin Wilson a model. He really wanted to be one of these guys who could write 3 or 4 books a year like Colin Wilson. And a lot of these little volumes that are being published by Alex Kurtigich, they seem to be attempts to write little books at a white heat to launch himself as something like a Colin Wilson. But they were experiments, and then of course they didn't really work. He never ended up being a kind of Colin Wilson figure himself, as much as he wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, Colin never really wrote. I mean, he did write quite a few novels, but they're in very conventional style. He never really went down the road that Bowden did, you know, in terms of experimental literature. But, you know, Colin always made his living exclusively from writing. Well, he did some teaching as well when he was younger, and lecturing So he made some money from that. But, you know, he had a wife and he had three sons, two with Joy and one from a previous marriage, and also a daughter. And he never did any other work. So he had to support himself and his family exclusively from writing. So it kind of inspired him to maintain this breakneck pace, you know, and to get into so many different areas. And I think his last books were published around 2009. He published nearly 200 books over the course of his lifetime. But anyone who's a Colin Wilson fanatic like me will tell you that only maybe a quarter to a third of those are really good books. The rest are, he ends up doing a lot of potboilers on true crime and the occult, you know, they're interesting to read for information, but the occult ones tend to be very new agey. I mean, some of his occult books are very good, like his very first one, which was just called The Occults, and there's one called Mysteries, and there's Beyond the Occult, and he wrote a couple of books on the idea of Atlantis, you know, the idea that there was a global civilization prior to the Egyptians. Those are worth reading, but most of them are just kind of schlock that, you know, he obviously wrote for cash. So I would never recommend to anybody who doesn't absolutely love Colin to go out and read all of his books. But if you read my article, both on the Countercurrent site or in North American New Right, I kind of give some suggestions on which the best ones are and where somebody should start with those.
Yeah, that's valuable. So why don't you just give us a rundown of like five essential Colin Wilson books, though, for our listeners today?
Well, I would say The Outsider is still one of his best. Really, that whole Outsider cycle, which is there's The Outsider, Religion and the Rebel, The Age of Defeat, The Origins of the Sexual Impulse, Beyond the Outsider, and then the very last one is called Introduction to the New Existentialism. Some of them are out of print, some of them are in print, but even the out-of-print ones are pretty easy to find because a lot of them were published at the time. I would say, actually, the most interesting one is Introduction to the New Existentialism, if you only want to read one, because he wrote it more than 10 years after The Outsider, and it was kind of his final statement on what he termed the New Existentialism, which he saw as an alternative to this sort of pessimistic existentialism that he saw in the French. It's a short book, and he really summarizes, you know, his whole trajectory of thought with existentialism and you know, his final reflections on it, which I find are the most completely developed of the books. They're all worth reading. I mean, you'll find food for thought in all of them, but if you wanted to only read one, I would say read The New Existentialism. His novels, he wrote many. Some I think are really good, some not so good. There's one that was published under two titles, The World of Violence or The Violent World of Hugh Green. That's about a young intellectual who sort of gets fed up with the meaninglessness of life and gets attracted to violence, murder. That's quite an interesting book. There's one called The Philosopher's Stone, which is about these scientists trying to further the capacity of the human brain for, you know, developing greater powers. And they actually discover that there are these creatures that have been preventing humanity from exceeding a certain level in its evolution. And it's actually part of the Cthulhu mythos of Lovecraft, which he was actually quite critical of Lovecraft, but he ended up writing several books in Lovecraft's universe. And that's the best of them, in my opinion, The Philosopher's Stone.
Interesting. My first encounter, I just realized what my first encounter with Colin Wilson was. And that is, I went and saw a movie from 1985 called Life Force.
Right.
I saw in the credits was based on a novel by Colin Wilson called The Space Vampires.
That's true.
And that basically cemented in my mind a completely dismissive attitude towards the name of Colin Wilson. So, yeah, that was definitely first introduction I had, and probably not the best introduction, I'm afraid.
No, even Colin hated that film, as he said. Oh, the interesting thing is I said he only made money from writing. It wasn't just books. He was hired in the 70s and 80s as a sort of script doctor for Dino De Laurentiis. And whenever there was a film where the script was at risk of going off the rails, Dino De Laurentiis would call Colin in and ask him to, you know, to basically, you know, fix the script and make it workable. I don't think he was ever given screen credit for any of those. He said he would just sort of lock himself in a hotel room for a weekend and, you know, hold his nose and go through whatever it was. He did mention to me once, though, that one of the movies he worked on was the 1980 Flash Gordon.
I was just going to ask. I was just going to ask if he had any involvement in Flash Gordon or Dune. That would be really fantastic to know.
He never mentioned Dune, but he did say he worked on Flash Gordon, and there are a couple scenes in that movie where you can kind of see some of his influence, where they're talking about consciousness and so forth.
That's fascinating. Did he mention any others, or is there knowledge of any others that he worked on?
I could ask Colin Stanley, who's his hardworking bibliographer. He was also a friend of Colin's. If anyone knows, it would be him. Also possibly Colin's sons. So the next time I see them, I'll definitely pose the question to them. But Flash Gordon is the only one I know for sure.
Well, that's hilarious. So let me ask you, you've mentioned knowing Colin's sons and so forth. You should fill us in. You actually knew Colin Wilson, is that correct?
Yeah, after I discovered his books in 1996, you know, the web was just a new thing then. And I was still a student, so I had, you know, free time on my hands. So I ended up creating this Colin Wilson website. And because the web was so new, at that time it was the only one online. And I just kind of did it for fun. I didn't really think anything of it. But I started to hear from a lot of Colin Wilson fans at the time who thanked me for doing it. And then after a while, I actually heard from Colin himself. And we struck up a correspondence for many years after that, although unfortunately I only ever met him in person once. He came to College Park, Maryland for the International Charles Fort Society conference in the year 2000. And I actually went to meet him there. He was there with Joy, and he was just a complete gentleman. You know, he was, you know, fascinating to talk to. I mean, he had so many different interests, and he always loved it, you know, when people appreciated his work. His lectures at the conference, you know, he gave them on Atlantis at that time, because that's what he was into in that period. They were quite interesting, but I'll never forget sitting with him, and, you know, we drank wine until midnight, which he insisted on paying for, and just traversing so many different topics. I mean, talking to him was just like reading one of his books. I mean, it was like this intellectual adventure, and he had a very good sense of humor as well. That's the only time I met him, unfortunately, and we corresponded for a while after that. I have to admit, I kind of drifted away, because then I started to read the traditionalists, and, you know, I got more into the right and the new right, the conservative revolution, all that stuff. And I never really turned my back on Colin, but I kind of lost interest in him. But in later years, I would say the last couple of years, I've kind of been going back to it and realizing, I guess you often do this with stuff you read when you're young, but realizing there was a lot there that I missed, you know, looking back on it when I was older. And yeah, I'm not going to say that he's got the answer to the riddle of the modern world or anything like that. But I think he has a lot of interesting contributions, and it doesn't depend on the sort of lofty metaphysics of the traditionalists. I mean, I don't want it to sound like I'm dissing the traditionalists. I find them interesting too, but it's not everybody's cup of tea. I mean, not everybody wants to think that religion is the answer to everything. So you might find somebody like Colin Wilson more interesting, because he definitely believed that there was more to the world than science could account for. I mean, that's why some people accuse him of only writing the books on the occult for money. I don't believe that, actually. I really believe, and this was reaffirmed when I met him, that he saw the occult as being related to the solution to the outsider problem. Because I really think he thought that the problem would never be completely resolved until we advanced in our evolution. And he really thought that things like the occult and the paranormal were like early manifestations of the fact that our brains and our minds are developing, you know, out of the animalistic into something much greater. And he, you know, he really thought it was the outsider's job to explore these things and to, you know, learn how to expand them and take advantage of them. So, you know, it was very much a kind of a Faustian way of looking at things. I did want to get that in that, you know, I think his stuff about the occult is, it's not everybody likes it. I know people who like his philosophical work who just think he went off the deep end. And yeah, maybe he did. It's a matter of opinion, but he was certainly serious about it. I mean, it's not, you know, he doesn't talk about, you know, getting channeled messages, you know, from supernatural beings or anything like that. I mean, it's very, scholarly and rational, his approach to the subject. So
did he ever read the traditionalists? That sort of overlaps with the occult, right? Did he ever get into that as far as you know?
No, I asked him about them once, and he didn't really seem to know anything about it. I think maybe in later years he came across the names of Eva and Ginnon, but I really don't think that those are things that would have been interesting to him, because he had looked into religion when he was very young. Like, he talks about how he considered going into a monastery for a while, but you know, he ultimately decided that religion was something from the past, and he really thought that if man was going to realize his potential, that he was going to have to, you know, create his own values. I don't think he thought that we could just get them from, you know, from reading, ancient sacred texts. I mean, he talks about the Bhagavad Gita and Ramakrishna and things like that in his early philosophical books. So, you know, I don't want to make it sound like I'm saying he rejected religion, but I think he thought we could learn from it. But I don't think he thought the answer was, you know, to go back and become religious. There certainly, you know, he certainly was not.
Well, that's very, very interesting. I do hope we've given a lot of food for thought for listeners out there to pursue Colin Wilson, to take him seriously. He was definitely a figure who inspires me because he was a freelance, independent intellectual. And that's a rare achievement in the modern world. And an amazingly productive writer. I wish I could be a quarter as productive as Colin Wilson. I'm going to try and get 50 books done before I'm dead. But anyway, I started reading The Outsider a couple of years ago, actually, when I was rereading Camus' The Stranger. And I set it aside because I got into something else. So eventually I want to pick him up again. The one book that I did read by him from cover to cover was it Mysteries or The Occult? I can't remember. Oh, I've read a couple of his books. I read his book The Misfits, which is about sexual perversion.
He was very interested in that.
Yeah, odd people. The only thing I remember about it, though, it was a real breezy, entertaining book. The only thing I remember about it was that Percy Grainger liked to be spanked. So I guess it didn't make that strong an impression on me. But
there is a chapter on Mishima in there.
You see, this bothers me that I don't remember things like that. Sometimes
that was actually the first time I'd heard of Mishima. I didn't encounter him in a rightist context until many years later.
Oh, but that's interesting. One of the things about Wilson's writing is that it's very, very easy to read. You just breeze right through it. And sometimes when a writer is that breezy, he doesn't make a permanent impression on my mind. Now, I'm remembering I did read some other books by Wilson. I read his book on Gurdjieff, and I read his book on Aleister Crowley, and boy, did he dislike Aleister Crowley, and he made a very strong case for regarding him as a, you know, narcissistic sociopath and a poser. I did read The Occult. That's the one that I now recall reading cover to cover. So I read The Misfits, The Occult, The Crowley, and The Gurdjieff books, and I saw Life Force, and I have a copy.
I would not recommend that people start there.
Yeah, don't start there. And I would like to to read more of his stuff. I have a number of other volumes by him on my shelves, including The Philosopher's Stone. I've just been waiting for an opportunity to actually read an entertaining novel. I'm just so damn busy. I'm so busy publishing and writing books that I don't have time to read other people's books, unfortunately, at least not for fun. So yeah, when I do something purely for fun, it's either listening to music or watching a movie. And I very seldom have an option, the opportunity of reading for fun anymore. It's just my life. Well, anyway, let's go into the Shop Talk segment. One thing that we should say is that, again, this discussion is based on John's essay in North American New Right, Volume 2, about Colin Wilson. We have done a lot of work in 2017. Countercurrents published 12 books. We got 12 books to press in 2017. We also announced a 13th title, and that's The World in Flames by Yaki, which has not yet gone to press. I'm going to send out an email to everybody who thought that was coming out on Christmas, basically, to let them know it's been delayed a bit. So maybe we can talk about The World in Flames and its delay. Basically, The World in Flames has been delayed because there's a lot of new material that we need to incorporate into it.
Yes, that's true. Carrie Bolton, who's the editor and also the source of all the, well, most of the material that's going into it, keeps finding new documents. I actually have to consult my list, but also I think you came across a few in that stuff that you got from Willis Cardo's estate, didn't you?
Right. Yeah, I bought a bunch of papers and books connected with Yaki from Willis Cardo's widow, Elizabeth. And in there, there was a file with an FBI report that had been obtained by Keith Stimley, who was doing research in a biography of Yaki back in the 80s. And apparently when Kyle Bristow, who is the guy who made the request to get all of Yaki's FBI files to help with Bolton's book. And it turns out that the FBI files that were released to us were not complete, because there was an FBI file that had been obtained in the 80s by Stimley in the Cardo papers. That was not there in the later release that we got through Bristow. And it turns out that it contains a lot of excerpts from Yaki's correspondence. And of course, we don't have any context for these. And of course, what the FBI was most interested in was things that indicated where he was at a certain time and place. But that's still very useful for biographical research. It just helps create a very fine-grained account of his travels in the 50s. So this is interesting. Of course, you wish that the full letters were quoted. Also, there's a letter from Stimley to Cardo where he lists all the contents of the briefcase that was seized when Yaki was arrested. And actually, there's an FBI file with those contents there. And it included a number of things that were described as obscene stories. So apparently, Yaki, for fun or money, was churning out pornographic stories. And it would be wonderful to find out who published them and under what name. Right. And there was also a long manuscript in there, a long typescript about Spengler and all this stuff. And when Stimley requested copies of this, he was informed that all of this had been thrown away in 1970 due to something paperwork or Paper Storage Reduction Act or something like that. So these utter Philistines dumped these files into the bin. And these salacious and also philosophical writings of Yaki are now completely lost to history, which is a really sad tale. So there was a lot of interesting stuff in the Cardo papers, a number of photographs of Yaki that have never been seen before that came from Yaki's family. There is correspondence between Cardo and Yaki's sister, Vinette, and also Yaki's daughter Isolde and Yaki's ex-wife. And it's quite fascinating. It's really quite fascinating. I wish there were more, but just getting these letters, these excerpts from letters is a significant addition, because almost no correspondence survives from Yaki.
We do have a few. Carrie's provided some as well.
Yeah. He got those from the Archand papers, I think, up in Canada. Yeah, so there is stuff that has survived, and more of it will eventually come to light. But we figured that we needed to include this because we have it now. Also, there's going to be a section of pieces that we believe that Yaki ghost wrote.
Yes, it was pamphlets that he published with Frederick Weiss, or Weiss, I guess. He was American. And they were published under the name XYZ.
Yeah.
And nobody knows precisely whether it was Weiss or Yaki who wrote them, because their ideas are very similar, but there are some that we believe were probably Yaki.
And stylistically, it makes me think that it's Yaki. And even if it's not Yaki, it's so close to Yaki's thinking, because he and Weiss collaborated, that it's useful material to make available again. And these things are almost impossible to come by. So it's worth adding those as well. So we need to come up with a new release date for The World in Flames, and then I'll send out an email to everybody who's pre-ordered. The book's going to be thicker and richer, and it'll be worth the wait. So that's an important change for our plans. But we did publish 12 books. We got 12 books to the press in 2017. By contrast, in 2016, we got 4 books to press. So we tripled our productivity in 2017, which is really nice. And in 2018, we might just double what we did in 2017, because we have so much material that's in the pipeline, including a number of pieces that were really imminent releases, but we just didn't have a chance to get them all to the printers before the end of the year. So expect in the next few months titles by Evola and Ludovici, as well as a new book by Tito Perdue. Another new book by Tito Perdue is called Though We Be Dead, Yet Our Day Shall Come. And there is a Polish translation of my New Right versus Old Right, which is in the works. There's a Czech translation that's going to be published sometime this year, and also a Spanish translation as well. So that's very exciting and gratifying to me. Also, 2 anthologies, one called Dark Right, essays on Batman viewed from the right, with a lot of really first-rate articles in there. And then my anthology that I put together called The Alternative Right, which has some first-rate contributions by people like Jared Taylor, Gregory Hood, Kevin MacDonald, Aidan Cassiel, and myself, and you as well. So, there's a lot of good material that is going to be coming out within the next couple of months. And then I'm hoping that this White Nationalist Manifesto that I was promising this year will come out in the spring. The reason why it's been delayed is that I was working on it last summer, and then we came under fire in this really disgusting campaign of slander put together by Richard Spencer and Daniel Freeberg. The first thing was launched on the 1st of June last summer, and that just sort of knocked me off my game, to be quite frank. But I think it's time to revisit that and get back to work on it. So that'll be out this spring, and I'm hoping to have it out by late April, by the time of the American Renaissance Conference in late April. So that's enough, I think, by way of teasers. Oh, I will tease our readers with one more thing that they've never heard a peep of before. We're bringing out a new book by Colin Cleary in the near future, and it is an essay, a book, a short book, called Wagner's Ring and the Germanic Tradition. So keep your eyes peeled for that. That should be out this spring, or perhaps in the winter, actually. Before the spring has sprung, we'll have a new Colin Cleary book for you.
That'll be great. Do you think we should mention the title of the Evola?
Oh, Avila's East and West. Finally, we're bringing that out, East and West. Collection. It's a collection of essays and reviews that are in comparative East-West philosophy. And this was published in a journal called East and West in the 1950s. And it was published in English, in English translations.
In an Italian journal, oddly enough.
Yeah, yeah. The original Italian texts have been lost, but there is an Italian edition that was a reverse translation from the English into Italian. So
what's that called, though?
Or Oriente e Occidente, something like that. Yeah, so basically East and West. Now, we really had to work hard on this because we didn't have the original text, and the quality of the translations, which are obviously done by a number of different hands, radically varies, and they're really, some of them are bad, really hard to read. And of course, we couldn't close our eyes and imagine what Evola was really trying to say here, because we couldn't actually cite the source, but we did at least try and work with what we had to clean it up and make it, you know, grammatically accurate and grammatically correct and smooth to read. Without having the ability to actually check some things against the original. And there are certain sentences in there that we think obviously are mistranslations, but we just don't know what to do with them. It's very, very sad, but this is the best possible edition of it. It is the most readable edition that you will ever find. And maybe someday the original Italian will come to light. But until then, I think this is going to be the primary access that most people have to these texts, that and the Italian edition.
I don't want to give people the wrong idea, though. I mean, I've been through it, and there are only a couple of places where I think things are still, you know, kind of incomprehensible. You know, 99.9% of the book. I mean, it's not easy to read, but Avila never is.
Avila never is. He's always demanding. This book has been gone through with great care by me, by Colin Cleary, who is the co-editor of it, and by John. So we have done our best, all three of us, to render this in the most readable possible way. And the few little remaining puzzles, well, they're just there. You can puzzle over them, and maybe you can come up with an interpretation that just escapes us. But still, the essays are of great interest. They cover a wide range of thinkers, East and West, and it's really some of Evola's most stimulating work, in my opinion. I love the essays in there on Iliada, on his work on yoga, for instance. I thought that was a wonderful essay. He has essays where he talks about Jaspers and Heidegger and Schelling, and all of them are quite excellent, and some of them are his most extensive discussions of particular thinkers. These are going to be like the canonical statements of Evola's views on certain people. So it's really worth waiting for. The Ludovici volume is called Confessions of an Anti-Feminist, and it's his autobiography, again, long delayed, but finally coming out. So 2018 is going to be a very, very good year for Countercurrents, and we hope you'll be with us, and you'll join us again next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio. John, do you have any last words?
No, I think that's good for the time being.
Well, thank you for bearing the brunt of this with this interview portion on Colin Wilson.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really, you know, I never would miss a chance to try to further further Colin's renown. So I was happy to do it.
Well, thank you so much, and we will be back next week.
Bye-bye, everyone.